listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski.
Hi, Mike. Hi, guys.
And across the table, we've got Brandon Birdsong.
What's up, Mike?
And next to him, we are honored to have Martin Uchek with us.
Well, thanks for having me tonight.
And next to Martin, we've got the one and only Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike. It's good to be here, but I'm always here.
And joining us from Austin, Texas.
Could it be?
It is Bill Burgess. Hey, Bill.
How's it going, dudes?
It's going great.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Whoa, we haven't seen Bill in a little while. It's good to see Bill.
Yeah, Bill's
good to see you guys.
Well, it's good to have you here joining us, and we missed you, buddy.
Missed you too, man.
And joining us today, we are privileged to have the one and only Gene Grimaldi from Oasis Mastering as our guest today. Gene, thank you so much for showing up.
Oh, good evening, guys. Happy to be here.
Gene is one of the mastering engineers over at Oasis Mastering and is a friend with Bobby Osinski. And if you go online and see Gene's credits, you'll see that he's pretty much mastered every kind of music known to mankind. There's a lot of great titles, including Lady Gaga, her latest. So we're going to be talking about mastering a little bit later on in the podcast.
Okay.
Anyhow, well, I just want to get right into it. Now, we've got a lot to talk about. There's a couple of questions that were posted on our Facebook page, and I wanted to get everybody's input. And right off the bat, there was a gentleman that posted a comment, Carrie, wanted to know what our opinions were of recording schools and recording programs. And I thought that was pretty interesting because there's a lot of recording schools out there. And, you know, right off the bat, you know, not all of them are bad. I mean, there's a couple you can tell the fly-by-night, you know, get a recording school, you know, certificate, you know, anything with a certificate. But let's just open it up. I mean, Bobby, your book is used in a lot of schools. What's been your
my opinion?
Yeah, your opinion, and not only that, but just your relationships with different schools. You know, have you seen any that have been really shady, and other ones that are better than others?
Well, my books are used in about 150 schools all over the world, and so I don't know personally about them all, but I do know that there's some that are better than others. There's one in particular that everybody in town likes the students, and that's the conservatory in Arizona.
Right.
And everybody loves the people that they get from the conservatory. From some of the others, not so much. They don't feel as qualified for some reason. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, they're paper mills. You know,
right.
Get the people in and get them out and take their money, unfortunately. That being said, I think you have to go to a school anymore to get a gig. And when we all started, it wasn't like that. There was no school
right.
for the most part. So what you did is you came up, you know, some of us anyway, started by, you know, sweeping floors and being a second engineer and learning as an apprentice under, you know, some of the better people and then graduating. And that was the way it was normally done, you know, back then. Now you almost have to go to school to get in the door.
Well, you got to go to school just to get your hands on some of the equipment because there's not a lot of studios that have big boards. The new boards, most of them are going to educational institutions, you know, like, you know, just from API, I know, you know, Michigan or NYU, I mean, they're the ones that are getting these big boards, which I think there's a lot of validity of getting trained on a big board. What's been your experience with some of the non-university type of schools? I mean, do you know, like, trade schools, more like the commercial?
I've taught in a couple of those myself, you know, over the years. I've taught Berklee College of Music. I was a teacher for a couple of years. I was a teacher at Trebis here in town back when they were going. I was a teacher at Nova Institute, which is kind of like a trade school
right.
as well. And You know, some are better. It depends on the instructors. You have good instructors, then people learn a lot. You don't have good instructors, then they don't learn a lot.
Right.
And sometimes I'm dubious. I hear from instructors all the time, and I'm dubious of some of them, I got to say. But, you know, a lot of them are good, and they're dedicated, and, you know, God bless them because they care. But a lot of them, you know, they don't. So,
Rob, what about you? Have you had any
I have. I've actually given some talks at schools and been involved with some schools, but I would kind of build on what Bobby was saying, that in the old days, we basically got experience by doing it and by going to a studio that, you know, had all this incredible equipment that we could never have on our own. And you learned by doing, and if you were good at the stuff, you moved up, and that's where your career came from. Now, most of the time, production these days is more of a solitary thing. I mean, right. You have a lot of people just producing on their own in their laptop or in their, you know, home studio or whatever. Right. And we've talked about it on the podcast before. The fundamentals haven't changed. You still, if you're mixing, you still have to know how an EQ works and
right.
a compressor and
right.
limiter and dynamics and you know, gain structure and everything. And these schools are really one of the few ways to get that knowledge now, because you're not going to normally get an apprenticeship at a big flagship studio. There aren't as many of them. And it's just the schools. I've visited some of the schools here in L.A., and I'm amazed at how awesome the equipment is.
Right.
I mean, if I was back at that age and trying to learn this stuff, I mean, to be able to just walk into a big SSL room and play with the thing, you know, that's something a lot of kids out of high school wouldn't normally get to do. So it is worth investigating schools for that kind of technology, because even if you're planning to work at home on your laptop using GarageBand or whatever,
right.
it's good to know how the real gear works.
Right.
And I think the school these days is about the only place to learn it.
I think, you know, that's true. I think one thing you can't get hung up on, though, with the whole school thing is this is – you know, the certificate of being a certified
yeah.
audio engineer.
Yeah, please email us if you've ever been asked to see your certificate going to work in a studio.
You know, that's a little ridiculous. And I know the listener who posted the post, you know, was mainly commenting about that. I mean, there's definitely some good things about being in school and learning, but don't get hung up on the paper that you get on the other side unless you're going to school and you're going to get a bachelor degree or something of that nature.
You know, really what it is, it's your ticket to get in the door.
That's all it is.
And if you look at it like that, then you have a really good outlook on right. the rest of your career. But if you think of it as something more than that, then you're in for a big surprise.
Well, and the other thing, too, is when you go into school and, you know, it's only going to set you up so that you can start to hustle when you get out of school. I mean, you can't rest on your laurels. There's not going to be, you know, studios that are going to be courting you saying, hey, come work with us. You know, it's not like a law firm where you're going to be able to go to all these interviews and the top 10 are going to go. I mean, you really have to either hustle on your own or hustle, you know, at studios that you work at. Like, we have interns over at the place that I mix, and you can really tell the different, you know, characters of the different students that come through and how they're going to do, because the ones that are the go-getters are the ones that will do anything, the ones that will edit and take the responsibility. You know that they're, you know, these guys are going to be employable because you want to employ them right then and there.
You know what I will say, too? I mean, like, if someone is applying for a job with us, and I know Scott, if he was here, would say the same thing, I can tell in 5 minutes whether someone can cut it or not. It doesn't matter. They could have a PhD in Pro Tools. Doesn't matter. If I see them working and they have no flow with it and it's cumbersome for them,
right.
I just know immediately it's not going to work out. So it's the certificate, I mean, it basically means nothing in the long run. It might get you in a door.
Right.
You know, if some employer wants somebody who knows Pro Tools and they see that you went to Full Sail and completed a Pro Tools course, then they're at least going to give you the shot to show them that you know Pro Tools maybe. But huh. it doesn't really matter beyond that. And what happens when you sit behind the keyboard and mouse is completely important, you know, much more important than the certificate.
Right. Bill, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say that the one aspect – I went to Berkeley, and the one aspect of the education environment is at a place like Berkeley can be so competitive that you right away understand what you don't know and how many guys there are that know more than you. And that in and of itself can be a catalytic for really getting your game on.
Because, oh, yeah.
You know,
competition.
When I went there, there was 400 other drummers.
Yeah.
Not to mention production people. And you kind of, it kind of flushes out your motivation for being in a place, for being in a career. And if you're willing and ready to get in there and rumble with that kind of competition, in and of itself is worth the money. And I think that in the case of Berkeley, it has done nothing but open doors for me. I mean, I went to Berkeley with a Buddy Rich scholarship, but, but it's, you know, it's just, it's gone well for me with the Berkeley thing.
Quick Berkeley story. When I went to Berkeley, I went as a student and I was in the composition program. And after a couple semesters, they found out that I had a degree in electronics and a lot of experience in the studio. I had played in a band that was the token white group on Delight Records, which is Kool and the Gang's label at the time. And they had their own studio. And I got to be in that studio all the time and got my chops together. So right. When they found this out, they said, hey, you want to be a teacher? And I said, well, yeah, okay. So I was a student and a teacher for a couple semesters and found out that does not work at all. And I just stopped and I became a teacher. So one day I walked into the teacher's lounge and I overhear one of the guys at the top of his lungs yelling to anyone who would hear, this place is a place for rookies or has-beens. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I thought, oh, I don't want to be a rookie and I don't want to be a has-been. And I was out of there. It made up my mind immediately. And I knew from then on I was going to go to California. And at the end of that semester, I was gone.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're neither a rookie or a has-been.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys know who Al Grundy is?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Al Grundy from the recording in New York.
Yeah, that's
the original
me.
Recording school.
Exactly.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, he was my teacher. And I met with him after, you know, high school and doing some electrical ditch digging work, you know, deciding I wasn't going to do that for a living, break my back, you know. So I went over there, interviewed with him, and it was all math, gain structures.
Wow.
And electronics. And at the end of the program, you got in the studio. So he was teaching you all gain structures, stuff we don't use, but we know, you know.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, how to get a signal, how to get the signal flowing through a console, basically. It was kind of interesting, you know, because you learn that.
Right.
And then it's always in the back of your mind, but you don't really use the math as much if you're a nocturner, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
no, but that's,
and all the kids, you know, when we were in there, we were like, oh man, we all thought this was over with algebra and trig, you know?
Yeah.
And then,
why do we need this? We're never going to use this.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was kind of like a test, you know, more of a test.
But that's the way Berkeley was as well. The first semester, you never touched any piece of gear. It was all theory. And then after that, then you gradually got into the studio by the fourth semester, or your last semester, your last year. You know, you were in all the time and you didn't have many theory classes, but, and it would weed people out because, you know, you get people that, if they wanted to do it, they would stick in and they'd know that there was a light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
And if they didn't, they would just get bored and leave real quickly.
Yeah. It would just weeded out a lot of people. Like all the chicks would drop out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They would, you know, they except a few, you know.
But
it's like.
I would have loved to have that kind of structure to learn with. I mean, I learned the opposite way. I was basically thrown into the lake, you know, to learn to swim. And that's actually one of my favorite old jokes. You know, I was thrown headfirst into the lake to be forced to learn how to swim, and I wouldn't mind it, but everybody else was skating. And that's kind of the way I learned, just learn by doing. And then as the years have gone on, I've tried to learn the theory to fill in the gaps in my knowledge. I do understand it would have been way, way, way better to be force-fed that kind of theory
right.
ahead of time. It might not have been fun in the beginning if you didn't realize it was something you were going to need so much, but It's invaluable. And like you say, to have it in the back of your mind all the time as just an automatic reference is a great thing.
But you know, it's funny because even the teachers, you know, there was like an analog synthesizer class, which was just, you know, it's like back then, man. It's like nowadays, I don't know, would they have that in a program?
In an archaeology course.
Yeah, basically.
Musical archaeology.
Yeah. It's like when you patch... pull from the connector, not from the wire.
Yeah. Sure, because everything is patch cords.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to be soldering these suckers.
Right.
The thing is knowledge, you know, one of the points that the listener put was talking about how much some of these degrees are. Because some of them, you know, some of these schools charge you thousands and thousands of dollars and people go into debt and things like that. And the way I see it is if you're going to make an investment and you're going to go into debt, you better do something with that knowledge. You know, you really got to be committed because it's the question that you hear when people talk about recording school. Do you take the 10 grand and go to school or do you buy gear and learn the gear? I mean, what's the
that's what I did.
You know what? The fact of the matter is, though, when people go to school, they go as much to learn what they don't want to do as to learn what they do want to do. And there's a lot of people, after you go to the school, you specialize in something, and you go, that's not what I thought it was, and I'm more into this instead. So what I found as a teacher was that there was a lot of people that they were really smart and they were into it, but not particularly, you know, this subject. And they would go on to do something else and be a lot better at it, but they'd figure this out by going to school. Unfortunately, it's a big bill that you got to pay in order to figure that out.
I mean, and you can't, you know, if you're going to go to school and you're going to spend that kind of money, if you're not dedicated, sold out, this is what you want to do, you know, leave. I mean, you're only going to do yourself.
I would recommend to any of the listeners out there, especially the young people who are thinking about going to school, get yourself a program like, you know, Propellerhead's Reason or something, which is the first thing I learned on 2.0, you know, where you can – it models the analog gear. You can flip it around. You can you can unplug things, route things differently, and start to teach yourself that way. If you don't have access to real gear, don't have access to a school, maybe that's the only way you can do it. Maybe you can't afford to go to the school. So you get, you know, you get some cheap software. You start learning that way, and then you sort of backtrack. It would be awesome to, you know, have all that stuff force-fed to you, you know, which would be great. But
you know, they have recording classes in high school now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of high schools that have that. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, even back when I went to school, way back then.
Last year?
That's right. Now, I went to a community college and I actually took an electronic music class in the community college that I went to. It was a pretty progressive community class back there in the 50s. But, no, I'm just kidding. But really, I got my MIDI chops, at that little free class that, well, it wasn't free, it was like $60, you know, back then. And it gave me enough to get my career rolling and touring. And I ended up doing backline and working with Stevie Wonder and meeting Rob and having a podcast. But, and then I also went to film school. Because I knew I wasn't going to be a music major and I went to film school and I started off and, you know, I learned enough about film and the production process and for myself in my second year of film school, I got the opportunity to tour. And so it was like, do I finish school or do I tour the world? And I toured the world and I dropped out of school, so I never finished my degree, but I was armed with enough head knowledge that I got in a structured environment. And, you know, I toured for 8 years and was on the road and didn't look back. And then as soon as I got off the road, I used my film school knowledge that I had back then and it got me my career that I have now. So I think, you know, any education, you never know when it's going to be handy, and it's always, always worthwhile if you act upon it, you know?
But, you know, Berkeley is very much like that, where the really good people that come from Berkeley don't graduate. They leave after the first or second or third semester. And it's just, they're so good that they get offers to go, you know, someplace, and that's the same thing. They'd rather work than be in school.
Well, and no one's waiting to see their diploma.
Yeah.
Right.
I have to say I quit after 3 semesters.
Case in point.
Exactly.
It's really weird when you're working in the whole audio environment and you're working in music. It's, you know, the degree just, it never comes up. I've read a lot of resumes. I've made decisions and help, you know, guide people getting hired and stuff. And not once has the degree ever really mattered, because you want to know, what do they know? What do they learn? You know, what programs have they had experience with? And then you meet them and, you know, just everything else. But
I, one very quick story. I went to Drexel University in Philly for, computer engineering, nothing to do with music or entertainment or anything, just straight engineering. And, they had one electronic music class. And so I took it just because I thought that might be something I was interested in. And I'll never forget, we had a work, like a workshop that had an Alpha Centauri synthesizer. And I think it had like an Apple IIe as its brain, and it was just a horrific piece of gear. But I just thought it was the coolest thing ever to be able to sit and, you know, I've been playing piano since I was three, so I just was excited to be able to play keyboards and, you know, mess with some technology. So I took this course, and I ended up getting a B.
A B.
And I wonder where I would have ended up career-wise if I'd gotten an A. But my my problem with that thing, it was like, you know, the tests were like, okay, where did Bob Moog grow up? It's like, I don't care.
Not interested. Right.
There was a lot of that kind of information. It wasn't that cool. If it had just been a lab thing, I would have done great.
Well, but it's so funny.
I did drop out of that school, too.
About those old synthesizers, because at the class that I was in, they had an EMU modular system.
Ooh.
And,
wow.
And it was really great to learn on that, because you talk about learning signal flow.
Oh, learning signal flow
from the oscillators through the filters to the, you know, the envelope, which it's you literally patching everything in on the envelope. And then you have to patch in the keyboard. If you wanted to use the keyboard, the keyboard was another thing you
patched. And those were the days when you could sit there and patch up a sound for like 20 minutes and hear absolutely nothing for the next 4 hours and just try to figure out why you're hearing absolutely nothing.
And the weirdest piece of gear that we got was, we actually got donated to the program, Captain Tennille's, like, a bunch of old, like, Mellotrons and things like that.
Oh, that would be cool.
And so, you know, we got our hands on these, you know, Mellotrons and all this just really bizarre gear that I would have never touched had I not gone to that quirky little program.
Cool.
But
did you guys all interned or –
No, I never did that. I never interned.
Okay. Never interned.
Not me either.
Okay. I was kind of curious, you know, if they do written tests for, you know, studios do that for the interns just to see what they really know, you know, to...
I don't... As far as I can tell from working at some of the bigger studios around town, I think it's more if you can show up on time and you know, how reliable are you, and oh, by the way, do you know how this works? And you know,
and the interns that I deal with, like when we have interns, I'll sit them in and I will show them a little bit of editing, but the really good interns already know Pro Tools,
right.
So they're already aware of that. So then I'll start, okay, editing. Well, they already know how to edit because they've been doing it in school and they've done a lot of class projects. And then we'll go into mixing. And usually they're familiar enough, but that's usually the mixing part is where – I will say mixing – it's like wine. It takes, you know, you're not just going to step into it because it's you got to feel and you just got to know. And it's just, there's a lot of these, you know.
Well, experience matters.
Yeah. That's where your experience is.
And well, cause our interns, when we hire them every once in a while, they just don't have a clue what mastering is. They want to fulfill their, the protocol for finding an internship at a studio.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes we get guys, you know, they just eat potato chips and they just sit on the front desk, you know, and just grease up the
That's all part of mastering.
Well, I have a question for you. Sure. When you get the interns in and they know Pro Tools already and they know editing, do they know how to make it sound good, or do they just know the procedure of how to do it? Because we all know that there's little tricks that in order to make things work that, you know, you have to have some experience in order to do it.
So here's what I do when I'm working with an intern is if they know how to edit, usually I'll get them – the very first thing that I'll get an intern to do is prep my sessions that I'm going to mix. I'll say, okay, here's how I want it. I want you to separate all the dialogue, the sound effects, music, and I want you to set up my auxes like this and just the basic thing. So once they learn how I work in my particular workflow, then the next thing I'll tell them to do is
get my coffee.
No, no. You know what? I could never do that. but then I'll after they do that a couple of times, because they're doing a lot of editing and cleaning up, you know, words and things like that, then I'll say, well, hey, you want to give it a shot? You know, and so they're familiar with the template. They kind of see how the workflow is, and I'll tell them exactly the EQs and stuff that I use, and then they'll sit down and they'll usually give it a shot. And some of them get really close really quick, you know, and they're using a lot of my setups that I have, and they're using like a lot of the compression that I already have set up, a lot of EQ already set up. But at least they're starting to hear how it's going to happen.
In the box or upward?
Yeah. No, this is all in the box. Okay. You know, because of just the recallability. So then they start going, and then the really good ones, and I've had a couple of really good ones. I'll let them mix, you know, spots that aren't too difficult and take it all the way to air, you know, because I think for them, it gives them a buzz if they can see their work, you know, on TV.
Something I found out recently that really blew my mind. I was interviewing Carmen Rizzo for one of my books. Yeah. Carmen's a great guy. But he was also a second engineer for, oh, God, the big English producer just slipped my mind. Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Who's the producer?
Trevor Horn.
Yeah.
Trevor Horn?
Trevor Horn, yeah. So, anyway, he worked on all these great Trevor Horn records. And I said to him, what's the secret of those mixes? And they sound fabulous. And he said, you know, Trevor used to let the assistants mix all the songs. I said, are you kidding me? He says, no. He said, the fact of the matter is they got all the sounds. They printed everything right in the beginning. Everything sounded terrific, and you couldn't make a mistake. So everybody was so tired at the end of the sessions, he'd just give the assistants the job. Went, okay, yeah, mix this. He said, that's what you heard.
Wow.
And that blew my mind. You know, because everything is so pristine.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that
yeah.
stuff, and you go, oh, man.
Yeah.
What, you know, how long did it take them to do this?
Yeah, just, you know what? That's a good point, though. If you're going to be an intern or an assistant, you just got to be ready to jump in there, you know? Yeah. And when someone gives you the opportunity, don't say no. Because yeah. I've actually had that happen where I've worked with interns. About 6 years ago, I was at another post house and I had an intern and I was the only mixer at the time and we were under a gun and I had to do a bunch of TV spots and he had been working and I said, hey, you know what? I really need some help. Why don't you take these spots? And so I set him up in another audio bay and he couldn't do it. It's like he froze. It's like he just, you know, and we were kind of under the gun because these were airing. And so we had to hit we had a hard deadline. And it's just like, you know what, brother? Good that you learned now. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to cover for you. But, you know, if you can't, you know, it's totally, you know, that's where you have to rise to the occasion.
You've
got to
not only rise to the occasion, you have to do it with passion and excitement, and you have to completely just obliterate the competition, because the moment you screw up, there's someone else waiting in line.
Absolutely.
There's way more people wanting to do the jobs than their own jobs.
Absolutely. And it's like that with just not only just mixing, but even like sometimes I'll have the interns do some sound effects editing. I was working on a giant commercial for a national brand and we needed to have some sound effects cut and I just happened to, there was an intern there and he had some audio experience and he also had some video experience, right? So he knew Final Cut and he also knew Pro Tools. And I said, okay, I need you to edit some sound effects for me. And I gave him the general parameters of what to do, and I set him up in a Final Cut bay because we didn't have any audio bays. And the guy came through in spades. He just edited some amazing sound effects in Final Cut, which is not an easy thing to do.
No kidding. Yeah.
And now, you know, when he graduates, it's like he's the top of the list that I'd love to hire if he's coming back out west. It'd be like, hire this guy because he came by, he totally succeeded, and you know, he's set because he gets into a place, you know, like where I work or any of the higher end places, he immediately jumps like 12 spaces, you know. Mm-hmm.
And where do your interns come from?
Different schools.
Oh, okay.
Just this one was from, I believe, Florida. I think
Full
that's
Sail.
Where. I don't think it was a university.
University of
yeah.
Florida.
Yeah, there's a
I think
whole
Full Sail is part of that right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are they connected now?
I think so.
No.
They're not?
No.
No, I thought they were.
Is that where you went?
No, I went to the University of Miami.
But all that to say is, you know, we'll be wrapping up because we're going to take a break right now because I'm choking. But, you know, it's not a bad thing to get an education in audio, and you just got to keep it in perspective. Do your homework on the school that you're going to go to. Ask questions, you know, and if they play up the certificate, be really, really leery about that because the certificate just means not much.
And there's more than just music.
Yeah.
You know, there's – I went on vacation to see my dad, and I think I went to Ford Aerospace, and they would record the space shuttles, and they had their own recording studio. And I walked in there. I was like 19 years old. I had shorts on. I was jogging, and I went in for the interview, and they were like,
"Next,
you don't want this job, dude. You want to be in a recording studio, I can tell."
Yeah.
You know? I go, "Why?" He goes, "Well, you got to wear a tie."
Where was that? Where was that for Ford Aerospace?
Houston.
Oh. Because I used to work for Ford Aerospace in Newport Beach. I used to drive a van.
Oh, okay.
Did you really?
Yeah, I was a driver shuttling people out of high school, shuttling people from building to building. And I did that till my window got shot out, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, Houston, Texas.
All right, well, hey, listen, all right, man. We're going to take a break right now, and then when we come back, we're going to talk more with Gene about mastering. All right, we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about colleges and schools and spending lots of money for your audio education, and we pretty much found out that all the guys working here didn't do it. No, but, you know, it's good. There's some good stuff, good people out there.
We're old school, though.
That's true. And you know what? And that's one thing that we've neglected to say is the a lot of this technology.
I did it.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Gene was good. But a lot of this technology, you know, we grew up with. Like, I started in MIDI when MIDI was starting. And so we had the really the privilege to see all these changes happen.
Well, we didn't have to go back and learn the basis for the technology because we were learning the technology as it was being developed in a lot of ways.
Well, that's true.
And I mean, how many of us went back and learned how wax recorders worked? You know, I mean, none of it. I didn't. So it's not like we were going back and looking at the basis. We were growing up with the technology.
Right.
MIDI and synths and tape machines and all that were just coming around.
Really, and we were kind of inventing our own things because, let's face it, before, you know, I got into touring and I kind of specialized in massive MIDI rigs, the stuff that I did with Teddy Riley and with Stevie, there were no other massive MIDI rigs before I started doing that. So a lot of the techniques and stuff that I worked on, I kind of helped develop. And
yeah, you're making it up as you go along.
Yeah, and then stole a lot of stuff that Rob did with Stevie.
That's you stole it, so I didn't have to do it anymore. That was okay.
I mean, some of the stuff that we did with Stevie's rig was just...
Oh, it was ridiculous.
It was insane. How many... We had two of the Synapses, which were like 15 by 32 or some ridiculous thing, per rack.
Right.
And all of them were filled up.
I mean, four of those giant racks. Well, and we were also carrying two Synclaviers, two Waveframes, and a Fairlight. I mean, it was an unbelievably huge rig, you know, for what you can do on your iPhone now.
I know. I mean, think about it. I mean, it just blows my mind. You could line up the racks and they'd be, you know, take up half a basketball court.
We were in a lot of magazines back then.
It was crazy.
It was, as Bill would say, it was bloated.
That's true.
One of Bill's favorite words.
Hey.
It was truly bloated.
Obese.
It was obese. Thank you. Yeah.
Tell you what, Stevie helped me get into Electronic Music Magazine because I got, that was like the highlight of my touring career is when I got in an article that a good friend of mine wrote about touring and preparing and things like that. So it was fun to stand in front of and take pictures with. A nightmare to run and to prepare.
Yeah.
Anyhow, let's move on. We are honored to have once again, Gene here with us. And let's talk about mastering. Mastering is the black art of the audio world to a lot of people. They think they know what it is, but they don't really know what it is. Yet, after they get their project mastered, they're really glad they had it done. And so let's just start off, you know, what would be a great definition on mastering? How would you define what mastering does?
It's balance. A mix is already balanced, and then, you know, you get someone else to listen to it, you know, somebody with experience, you get their take on where it should be. What we're going for is, you know, impact and making sure tracks are balanced between each other. More or less, when it comes down to it, it's the big picture, you know, of a mix.
I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's really a great thing. And I like what you said, a second set of ears.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about balance, it's not just balance within that song, but as a mastering engineer, I'm sure you look at the whole record and its balance amongst the songs, right? I mean, making sure they kind of all kind
of flow.
Exactly.
You know, true. Today we're doing a lot of singles. So sometimes I don't do an album, but I'll do the singles.
I got you.
And then if I do get an album, I'll redo the single to match the album, because there are times when I'll just make that single as loud as it'll go, you know, and it won't fit in with another track next to it, you know. In the sequence, so you know, I have to redo it sometimes. You just have to, when the mixes start coming in, because sometimes they come in from all different producers and engineers also nowadays. You know, it's not just one mixer doing a whole record,
right?
For the most part, on pop records, because there's all different features, you know, featured artists and stuff, you know. They're going for a different sound on tracks.
And things are blending together, and you got the remixes, and you've got the
tons
the
of remixes.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's start, you know, from the beginning, and even before, because one thing I want to pick your brain about is what kind of things as a mixer can we do to help you as a mastered engineer? But even before that, what kind of things do you do as a mastered engineer? Obviously, there's EQ, but you also deal with compression, and you deal with, you know, dither and resample and downsample and upsample. I mean, what are some of the tools that you use to when you actually do master?
Well, the main tools are the compressors, EQs, and then there's the dithering products for creating a CD, you know, that's in the final stage before you manufacture the master. That's where the dither goes in the last stage. You know, it's again just using those tools. It's like a sophisticated stereo system,
right,
more or less, but in a controlled environment where you can hear a lot of detail and make your judgments on, you know, whether a mix needs some bottom end or the mid-range needs to come up a little or, you know, the high end, you know.
I got you.
Yeah.
You're still using a look-ahead limiter, right, at the end? And the chamber?
Sometimes. I don't usually use a limiter, but there are times when I use it to fix things. Mm-hmm. I go by ear. You know, I want it to hit. I want impact, man. I mean, it's like, you know, I want that little speaker when it's turned down low to be popping. You know, I want to feel the snare.
Nice.
Or I want to feel the kick. You know, I'll put a pocket in EQ around an area and just build it up even more to make it hit harder. You know, just to make that speaker pop.
You know, it's really interesting that you said that.
I take it to the limit, too. I mean, you guys, you know, there's a lot of loudness wars, but
right,
I like to use all those bits up. It sounds better. And,
well,
and you know, if you ever tried to master on your own or mix on your own,
right,
let's say mix on your own, each time you mix louder,
and do another louder mix until it starts to clip, and you see which one you like better. You know, I mean.
Oh, clipping is good.
I mean, before you hit the clipping, right. You know.
Right. Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was, I think I read on Bobby's blog when he was talking about Oasis how I think you said that, you know, you used to use limiters, but now you rarely use limiters at all. You know,
I use my ears, and when I hear something that creates a problem that I can't get out of, I'll use a limiter, and then I'll cut that piece in where it needs to sit, just in that area where, you know, like pianos are notorious in digital when digital clipping occurs.
Right.
So there's like no way to get out of it but to use a limiter if you need to have that level.
Right.
Because otherwise you're going to be reaching for the knob, you know, the volume knob, and it's just that's not going
to
work.
So why would you prefer to stay away from limiters?
Because I get overall the average of the song where it's not clipping it just sounds better. And then just for that one split second to fix something, that's what I use it for. Because I just don't want to take away any of the impact.
Because it seems like the look-ahead limiter is part of the reason for the hyper-compression that, you know, is kind of standard today. And it's because, you know, you can hit it so hard and squash it so much without going into overload, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know.
I'm not saying it sounds good.
I can make a good-sounding record, and it can still be loud. But, you know, I mean, it's not over the top or anything.
Right. What is the secret to that without using a limiter?
Gain.
Just... Do you a lot of gain
Straight
stages?
Straight on gain, yeah. Gain stages. Build your gain stages up, you know. I usually start with gain before I start dialing EQ because when you bring up the low levels, everything's brighter, you know. Everything gets brighter and you can hear everything better. And then the top stuff just gets truncated, so you get square waves, you know. And sometimes if you go too hard, you'll hear it pull in on itself, especially when you have deep bottom, you know. And, you know, you got to have taste now to know when to back off.
Now, isn't there a problem with if you get a mix that's already squashed and compressed? I mean, there's not much you can do.
I get that so much nowadays.
Well, let's talk about that right now. Let's talk about... now that we know a little bit about what you do and some of the tools that you use, if I'm a mixer and I'm just mix this band and I want to bring it to you, what are some things that I should avoid? What are the rookie mistakes? What are the things that you want me to do that's going to help your job in the mastering process?
I would say, you know, use all the gear you like to give color to your mix, but at the end, do not put a finalizer on it. That's the one key thing to me because it really closes down the impact of the mix. I mean, yeah, you want it loud and you want the record company to make sure it's loud, but send the mastering guy a different mix because sometimes you want the label to hear it nice and strong and loud. And I end up getting those mixes. So
it's and then there's nothing you can do.
No, except I call up the mixer. If it's an outstanding mix, I'll call them up and just say, hey, man, take off the limiter. Let me do it here because I could dig a little more, you know. Otherwise, you're using really sharp cues like on 16, you know, or like I don't know. Like I'll use a Cambridge plug-in EQ and you know, I would take the cue – as tight as it'll go and just roll intense, you know. Otherwise, you know, just to get a little bit more energy out of areas that make it more punchier, you know, make the track more punchier.
Now, if we're working on something like hip-hop or something R&B where we want a really lot of low end, do you want us to just pump that low end up, or can we actually give it to you and say, hey, can you throw another octave on any of that low end or any of that?
I'm always like, get your mix as close as possible.
Okay.
Yeah. The less you do in mastering is actually the better, you know. To me, I mean,
when you have to start twisting the knobs, you know, you kind of run into the situation where you tend to, if you need bottom end, you're going to get everything in the area of what you're going for. You right. know, you're going to get the bass, you're going to get the kick. You know, you're going to get some of the low guitar, maybe bass guitars and synths. You know?
So paint the picture. I mean, make it as complete as possible.
Exactly.
Except for the compression, except for the mastering.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind two bus compression. You know, there's a lot of good compressors out there that, you know, mixers use their compressors on, and it's killer. You know, outboard gear, it always helps because I'm a minimalist when it comes to, I like it pristine where I'm not coloring the sound and I'm just, you know, giving you impact and balance. I don't want to mess with the tone too much if I don't have to.
Didn't you do something for T-Bone Burnett? Who am I thinking of? Oh, Reichhuter.
Reichhuter. Reichhuter. He brought in his, a radio console that had tubes in it. I can't think of the name of it. I forget. It was
a Fairchild too.
He had a Fairchild compressor, but he also had this
real one.
Wow.
He had the it was rented. It was a rental.
Oh.
We mastered Chavez Ravine, an album that he did about, you know, Dodger Stadium. And he did a book on that. It was a book and a CD that went together. And I didn't even know at this stage. He after I mastered it, he went back in the studio and remixed it all again just because that's Reichhuter, you know. He wanted perfection. Anyway, after I did the mastering, got it sounding really good, and he was pretty happy with it. He goes, now run it through these two pieces of gear and make it like it's a big, massive energy coming at me. Like, that's kind of how he described it, like a big ball of energy. Like, I don't care if the stereo goes away. I just want a massive sound coming at me, and just see if you can get it by running it through this Fairchild and this his little radio console. It was nothing but buzz coming out of the console, just buzz and hum. And, you know, I just ran it through it, gave it to him. I go, do not use this.
Sometimes things seem like and a
then,
more creative.
And then the Fairchild just lost all that pristine high end.
Right. Yeah.
It just became soft and mushy. And
is that what he used?
No, he didn't use any of that. He went back and remixed everything again. So, and I don't know what happened after that, to be honest with you. But it's interesting when clients bring in their gear.
Right.
Sometimes we do Pro Tool sessions in the room where we're mixing and mastering at the same time. And sometimes I'll get some stems. I'll get all the vocal tracks and then the instrumental tracks, you know, and then I get to play around a little bit.
Oh, that's
that.
Cool.
I mean, you know, it's
but that's an insecure just, mixer.
A lot of mixers would not allow that.
I'm like, you know, you either got it or you don't, you know, at that point. But, you know, it could be done. I don't prefer to do it that way. I mean, because when it comes out, people aren't going to know the difference, you know. I mean, they're going to get used to the way it sounds. You know, that's the way it's going to be, you know.
Right.
You're just going to get used to it.
You guys used to do a lot of shootouts. You still do them? I remember where, you know, for a while.
Yeah, Eddie and I, were both doing shootouts, you know, all the time. So,
Explain what that is.
Yeah, why don't you explain?
A song will go around to all the mastering engineers, and then they'll pick the one they like, and then, you know, then you more or less get the record, you know. Sometimes, you know, they're not, you know.
But they don't pay for it, though, right?
You know what I do now? I do a half. I do a hook. I do a verse and a hook, and that's it. They don't get the whole song.
Yeah, makes sense.
You know? It's just the way it is. I mean, we don't even set up any – no FTP file, you know, transfer addresses for these kind of clients. You know, they you know, if you like it, then – you know, book a session.
We'll explain that now, the FTP site and everything that you have, because that's changed a whole bunch in mastering, where at one point in time you walked out with the master, or it got sent to the pressing plant, and now it's all done via online.
Exactly. You know, sometimes we're not even making masters anymore. We're just major record companies we are. Some are doing theirs in-house, but we just upload it. They put it together. Like we have European clients that'll do all their sequencing, or overseas clients, Asia, Russia, or wherever, you know, Netherlands. They'll do their own sequence, and if they don't want us to do it, I'll put the files up with the spreads between the tracks. This way they can hear the spreads too together, because when you put the files up, they don't get the sequence.
The spread is the
space between the tracks. Mm. You know, they won't get those, you know, if I just throw the songs up there, because they would build their own, you know, I don't know what they're thinking.
You know, the other thing that a mastering engineer does that people that do it at home don't realize, and usually can't do it because they don't have the gear to it, is the PQ codes for CD and the ISRC codes and
all
that stuff that people just, they don't know about. And even if they know about it, they're not capable of doing it unless they have, you know, sophisticated mastering software.
Exactly. You know, we're still, you know, putting that on each, you know, it automatically goes on a CD, you know, when you do it. But ISRC codes are, you know, you get those from the RIAA, and I think it's a one-time fee if you're a major label, or if you're an artist that you put out albums every year. You know, it's kind of cool to know where your songs are ending up. You know, if somebody's jacking them for a compilation, you can keep track of them, or it's a little code that goes, you know, along with each track, and it sits in the substream of the digital audio. So,
and you can sign up with the RIAA and get your own.
Exactly.
You just
go right on. Yeah, $75.
Yeah, it's a one-time fee, $75, and then you can assign your own ISRC codes from then on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Track your song. It's good. A lot of our indies clients, they're all putting them on there. You know. I mean, I'm not sure if iTunes offers that, but they probably do, you know.
What's the relationship, the ratio now between, at one point in time it was mostly major labels that you had, and now it's changed between indies and labels, right? The ratio of work coming in.
I'm getting a lot of singles from indies, from the labels, and, you know, I'm just doing one song, you know, like, and getting a lot of remixes too. I do a lot of remixes now. You know, I got the Gaga record, and now it's like Remix City, and every little teeny bopper girl, you know, has come. You know, wants to work with the engineer that did the Gaga record. So it's okay. I mean,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's totally fun. You know?
Write it while you can.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, I did some hard rock the other day, you know. I did just singles, though, you know. You got to wonder, you know, it's going back like it was the 50s, I guess, now, you know, where you're just getting a single, just getting a taste, you know, see what it does, and then see if it sticks to the wall when you throw it out there, you know. And if it does, then you're going to see an album come down soon.
Does this mean that the label is not doing the album, or they're not mastering the album?
It's hard to say, with, you know, because sometimes, like I said earlier, I'll get a single, but I may not do the album. But, you know, it's kind of.
But someone else might be, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, it just happened recently because I was tracking a song that was number one, I think, last week that I worked on. And, you know, the album's already out, so I didn't do the album, but I did the single.
Do you guys do vinyl at your place?
We cut off-site, subcontract. Okay. We're trying to get a hold of a lathe, maybe two lathes. Mm-hmm. But if it happens, you know.
What's old is new again.
Exactly, you know, it's like, well, and, you know, it's, kids are starting to get into digging through their parents' record collection. Right. You know, and they're wow, man, you open this up and you see a nice big picture and wow, it's crackles, man.
Yeah.
You know, on a record.
Well, let me talk really quick a little bit about get your opinion on some of the new, old, new, I don't know, it's all blur, mastering. We're like, I had a friend who just finished an album and a couple songs got mastered through actually getting a vinyl master cut for the mastering. So the mastering engineer went to vinyl and then recorded that vinyl record one time back into his system. And so it was weird. It was like the mix goes to vinyl one time, one use, one playback for the vinyl, goes back into you know, whatever DAW that he was using.
He was going for a sound, I guess.
Yeah,
a vibe.
But it was vinyl mastering, as they call it.
Huh.
And I'm just wondering if you heard about that, or like anybody here, like Clasp, using Clasp for the mixing or anything.
That's kind of like rolling through a tape machine.
Right.
Right.
And
then, yeah, you know, somebody called wanting to do that the other day, and I think I take that back. They wanted to buy tape from us, is what they wanted to do. And it's like, yeah, I don't know where you can get tape.
But have you?
No, I have never, not rolling through the lathe. Actually, you know, when I worked at Future Disc, somebody did a session with Steve Hall, the mastering engineer at Future Disc. He went exactly the same way through the lathe into his console, you know, went from half inch tape through the lathe,
right,
and then to the console.
Oh, well, that makes sense. So you get the sound of the limiter.
Yeah.
And that was, for vinyl, it was especially, you know, fast limiter because they needed it to keep the transients down.
Yeah, especially on the high end. It's, you know, it really softens the sound a lot.
Yeah, it's you know what, because I actually heard the mixes and
you got to hear before and after.
Yeah, afterwards I can play. I actually have them here, so if you're interested.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
but what it does is it the center, something happens in the center. It just kind of mushes it together, but not in a bad way, in a very musical way. But it just kind of. It's weird.
There's a low frequency crossover that kind of sums the bottom end. If there's stereo information,
yeah, it makes it mono.
Because you kind of run into you could run into overcuts, you know, and lift outs from the vinyl. So if, let's say the setting on that. Maybe tweak the roll off on the filter, you know, to
you know,
mono
that would,
more.
That would make sense because you still had the spread of the high end, but there was this mush, this mixing in the middle.
I'm sorry, but I have to say I think it's way better to do those kinds of effects on purpose while you're mixing and not rely on putting everything through some kind of wonder box at the end to fix the fact that you put a stereo kick drum or something on your
record. I will say that in this particular case, the mix was very retro sounding. It sounded like something you'd get back in the 60s. And
so if you're going for an effect.
Yeah, and actually it worked. Yeah. And they didn't do the whole album, by the way. They only did like two cuts that were in that style. But
if you're doing it as a specific effect, that's good. But a lot of people hear about a process like that and then start to rely on it like a crutch.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Which brings up a good point. What are some of the more horrendous mistakes that you've heard come through your bay?
Well, we get out of phase material, you know, and you can't fix it when it's you know,
still,
it doesn't happen too often, but when it happens, you know, you got to make that phone call, say, hey man, check your mix, something's out of phase, you know.
So is it the whole mix or
one part? Yeah, immediately you hear it in the intro usually, you know, and then sometimes you can fix it if it's isolated in the beginning, but once it's in the track, you can't fix it, you know. It's just, you know, a mistake, that's all. It just gets by, you know, and it's like.
Or if it's on the drum track, it can never be fixed.
Right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So
I was going to point out two things because we do a fair amount of mastering at my place, and one of the weirdest mistakes we've had happen, and it's happened more than once, is people brought in files. They were using Pro Tools, but they were using either Apogee converters or some other converter, and they had their sample rate set to, say, 48K, but they had an external sync, like a Big Ben or something, coming in at 44.1. So they thought they were working at 48K, and all the files are flagged as 48K, but it's actually 44.1 information. So when you go to play the files back, they're all at the wrong pitch.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare, especially if you then want to be able to master staying in the digital domain.
Right.
You got to use some really fancy sample rate converters and that stuff. So if you're using external sync in your studio, make sure you know what you're doing and everything is set the same. And the other thing I was going to say is when people bring in material, like you said before, it's horrible if you bring it in already pre-crushed and, you know, limited just, and just
there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, you can't undo it.
You can't. You can't.
But it's just the other thing that people don't realize is if you're working in a 24-bit system, you have tons of dynamic range. You don't have to worry that you're not using every bit. It's okay if your mix peaks at -3 or -6 or -10 even, especially for most pop music. You're never going to hear it. Leave the mastering engineer a bunch of room to work. Even if your mix seems really, really soft to you when you're listening in your studio, that's what the volume knob is for. Turn up your speakers. But make sure that you're leaving plenty of room for the mastering engineer to do his thing.
Yeah, each mix, you know, that you do is just, you just refer it to some of your favorite mixes, you know. It's
definitely.
It's key, you know. I mean.
And I like if people, if they're doing a certain kind of music and they have other favorite albums that are in the same genre, if they tell you those albums so you kind of know the kind of sound they're going for.
Exactly.
I mean, it doesn't help if they're doing hip hop and they happen to like, you know, some violin concerto to do that. But if it's the same genre.
I tend to get the make it sound like this record, and it sounds nothing
right.
like
it's
it.
It's totally different.
Yeah. It's just nothing.
The other thing that I like about you guys over at Oasis is the fact that, you know, obviously mastering engineers have their following, then, you know, the mixing engineers, producers that always want to use the same mastering engineers. And once you get comfortable, then you're able to send a mix over before you really get into it and say, well, are we in the right track or we're not? And it's really good.
That's a very cool thing to do, actually.
Hear back from the mastering engineer saying, oh, man, you're way off here, or, you know, you got to check this, or, hey, you know, you're right there. And it's so important.
Yeah, we do it. I do it now a lot. It's so easy now because you got
the
mixer.
On an FTP
site. He's across. I could even check by an MP3.
Sure.
You know? I could check balance by an MP3.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a point that I want.
You know, and it's easy to get over. You know,
do you make the MP3s for
sometimes
distribution?
Sometimes I do. Yeah, and you know, mine doesn't have I don't add an extra dB to it. You know, like iTunes. I think every time I play back an iTunes MP3, it's always in the red. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, and a lot of encoders will add.
You know, and you know what happens? It brings up the mid-range, and it sounds, I don't know, a little bit harder to listen to. Like you kind of get some ear fatigue, you know, because it's an MP3 to begin with in the first place. But jacking the level up doesn't really help it much, you know, and there's no way to compensate for that, you know. Once it leaves the studio, you know, either as a 16-bit, or if I make my own MP3s, there's no saying, you know.
Right. Now, let me, and this is all great stuff. As a mixer, when I'm mixing and working on a song, how do I listen to that song when I do the playback through a mastering engineer's perspective? I mean, what do you listen to on the big picture? Like, if I wanted to start teaching myself how to listen like a mastering engineer, how would you describe that? What is that experience? Because I know as a mixer, I would listen in on the parts and see the blend I'd be very in the mix, you know, with the balance of the different instruments. But to me, mastering engineers always seem to be looking on the outside, the big picture. And what is it that you listen for? How can I train myself to, I don't want to be a mastering engineer. I just want to be able to listen like a mastering engineer.
Yeah. There are times when you just don't touch something. You follow me, right? When you listen to a mix, let's say you got a mix and it seems dark to you, but you know when you hear an S from, let's say, a singer, that that's the high end right there. The S is going to be the top, the sibilance. You just get that balance, and it's going to be right, even though it's, let's say the mix is just dark, you know. You just got to know that's the vibe they're going for, you know, and you just want to leave it how it is, you know, and you don't want to change it too much. And I'm trying to, you know, when I listen to a mix, I just want to, like, try to envision what the mixer's thinking and what the artist is going for.
Let me interject something here, though. One of one of the things that kind of prohibits you from listening like that is the fact of the precision of what he's listening to.
Right.
And the rooms are fabulous. The speakers are, you know, have an extra bunch on top and a bunch below that you can never hear anyway. So you can be as much in the mix as you can, yet you take it into their room and you go, I never heard that. It sounds so much better, so much worse.
Right.
So there's that precision that you don't hear and you can't hear most of the time.
But let's say he can, right?
Oh, well, okay.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, you know, there are a lot of mixed rooms that sound great, though. Right?
Yeah. But they don't sound like you're, you know, mastering.
Well, I haven't been in a lot, but I've been in maybe down the street. I've been in my buddy Bob's room, and it's just an ATC system, and it's, well, we helped set it up, so, you know, it sounds really good. And his mixes, when they come in, they're pretty much on. I mean, I don't do too much, you know. I work, like I said, I work in tenths of a dB, not in,
right.
You know, in the old, you know, in analog days, it was halves and ones and, you know, 2 dBs. And now, you know, I'm hearing so much better in my studio. You know, it's a really nice environment to be in. You know, it's a concrete bunker, you know, basically, you know, so it's like, it's right over the flight path of Burbank Airport. You can't hear anything in there.
It is a bunker.
It's a bunker.
Do you find sometimes that with an album you will maybe focus on one song and try to bring everything else closer to that song?
Yeah, you know.
Sort of pick a midpoint?
Yeah, you know, when I have attended sessions, you know, a mixer or a producer would say, start with this track. This is what we were going for, you know, and then make everything kind of match this. You know, this mix, and it's good. It's good. Good reference, you know. And if I have something that, you know, in my box of CDs that I like to compare it to, I'll pull it out, you know, and just say, yeah, I think you're there, you know.
The other way I've seen you guys work is you go through all the songs, all 10 songs, and find one that seems like it's the closest to the finished product, and then compare everything to that. Use that as the standard sort of.
Yeah. You find that the killer mix of the group, you know. And then there are some that just stand out and they're just different, you know. And you just let it ride, man. I mean, you know, you got a bright one, you know, or you got a darker one. It's just part of it, you know. It's part of the album experience, if it is an experience nowadays, you know.
Right.
If kids play through records. It's hard to say, you know.
Yeah, not that often.
No, I know. I did a record. I had one mixer, and he goes, why are my mixes so low, man? And I'm like, well, I can't get the other ones as loud as yours because your mixes are better. And he goes, well, kids don't listen to records now. Just make mine go for it, man. Just make it as loud as it'll go, you know. So it's like, okay.
That's a shame, man.
Yeah, it's like, because I'm a playthrough guy, you know, especially on a record, you know, that's really good.
Yeah.
I play it from top to bottom, you know. So.
That's a shame.
Well, chiming in.
I was just going to say one thing in answer to your question as well. You said, how can you listen more like a mastering engineer? I had it explained to me years ago in a way that actually made sense to me. And it explained to me also why some people can, you know, make a record but not master it, and vice versa. But when you're making the record as a musician or a producer, or sometimes as an engineer who's involved on the creative side too, you're listening to the melody and the chords and the song and the lyrics, and you're paying attention to what the song means and the emotional content of the song. To really be a great mastering engineer, you have to be able to listen to the song kind of without hearing the song, just by hearing the frequencies. And I've worked with some mastering engineers where I've just been talking to them afterwards,
and say, well, what do you think of that song? And they say, I haven't actually heard the song. I'm not listening to the song. They're not paying attention to the melody or the lyrics or what each instrument is doing. A lot of times they're making sure, especially if you have a good, competent engineer who's mixed the thing
right.
and the client is happy with it, they're making sure that what the client and engineer had in their mind is going to translate to the most speakers on earth mm-hmm. as close as possible. And so the mastering engineer is there to basically take your vision from the creative studio and do as little as possible to make it work as well as it can on the biggest number of speakers. And it was a really interesting thing when I spent time on this mastering session, and it was actually for a Stevie album, that even after a whole day of this stuff, he really didn't have a strong idea about the songs, but frequency-wise, he basically understood the complete spectrum, you know, that was being used and how it was being used and what he needed to tweak to make it, you know, better for the world.
Yeah, he was listening for balance, too, for overall
frequency balance.
Frequency balance to play on from a boombox to your laptop
right.
to an MP3 player. Yeah.
And that's a very tricky thing. Try to listen to music and just think of it in terms of the frequency ranges. And I've read several books on mastering, including Bobby's, and in one of them, they're a bit of a blur, so I don't remember which it was, but one of them actually started you by training your ear by learning what frequencies certain things happen at. Like the human voice is often at this many hertz
right.
and a bass
right.
is often this many.
Yeah.
And start to get familiar to the point where you know where the meat of a snare drum is and the meat of a kick drum is and start playing with EQ.
Right.
But you're not listening to it as a snare drum. You're listening to it as a thing that's putting out mid-range mm-hmm. a certain way that has to sound balanced on different systems. And you can train yourself to listen a different way, but I don't think – I've never met anyone who was an incredibly great you know, creative recording engineer and an incredibly great mastering engineer. It's two different skill sets to me.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And even more than skill sets, it's two different God-given talents, I think. It's just different skills.
Yeah, that's why, you know, mastering engineers, they are just – they're just
– they're worth the money.
They are. You know, cause especially – I've been involved with a couple of sessions that have gone to mastering – and you hear them talk, and they'll listen to the song, and the first thing they'll say is, oh, yeah, well, 2K's a little harsh there. Hmm. You know, just they just nail the frequencies.
All right,
like, boom.
Are you guys doing commercials or film mixing? Or are you doing albums?
I do post-production where I do, but when I did the mastering, it was working on, like, friends' albums and things like
okay.
that.
Okay. I mean, I've mastered commercials, you know.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Stuff for commercials, stuff for, like, film trailers.
Yeah. You know,
all different.
It makes
stuff.
A huge difference.
Yeah.
And let's face it, there's no such thing as a demo anymore.
Yeah.
If you're an independent artist, you're not making a demo. You can call it a demo.
Yep.
You know?
You shouldn't.
But you shouldn't because if somebody likes it, it's now a single. You know? There's no such thing as demos. If you're doing something that you're considering as a demo, but you want to get it onto iTunes or you want to introduce it to labels or whatever, get it mastered. You will not believe what a major difference it makes. And running it through some multi-band limiter that you don't really know the controls of is not the same as getting it mastered.
The key is you need the right room. You need sophisticated acoustics, good ears, the equipment to go that goes along with it too.
Yeah, it's the whole package.
I mean, face it, two different mastering engineers with the same gear, same room is going to do a different thing.
Right.
You know, it's just taste, you know. It's like going out to dinner, you know, to a fine restaurant. You're going to get it's going to be balanced, you know, but it's going to be different, you know. That's where the shootout comes
right.
in, you know.
It's still an art. It's an art. It's not just a science.
And apparently you've won quite a few shootouts because your credit list is a mile long. Well, hey, listen, we're going to have to wrap this up, but that went way too quick.
That was cool.
I mean, Gene, thank you so much
for
coming in here and just opening a little bit of
Come back again, maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
Bring some mixers in.
No.
Oh, cool.
Well, definitely. We'll do a little mastering powwow with some mixers, and you guys can yell at each other. Right. Well, you should.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's a whole nother story. but thank you once again. And Gene's over at Oasis Mastering, and do you want to plug your studio?
Just give us a call. Yeah, Oasis Mastering Burbank. And the website is www.oasismastering.com.
And I'm sure with, you know, the Internet and the age of FTPs, you probably get clients all over who've never even seen you face-to-face but have worked with you on many sessions.
It's the way it is, man. They just I don't even know who's working on what nowadays. Wow. I get files over and I'm like, wow, man, this is a great mix. I wonder who worked on it.
You know,
that's amazing.
Before it is.
I mean, it's
compared to the old days.
I get initials like on the file,
right.
And I'm like, oh, who can this be?
Well, before we go, I want to ask you: do you mastering like? Do you get supervised sessions? Is the client ever there as you're mastering? Do you work mainly unsupervised?
I get the clients that come in and they tell me what they want and then they say, oh, I guess you were right.
I guess you were right.
Yeah. When we're redoing it the second time, you know, cause they don't, it's funny when a client comes in and doesn't know your room.
Right.
You know, they kind of like make you second guess decisions that you want to make, and you're like,
well, because it is really weird if you've never heard your stuff in a mastering studio.
Yeah.
It does sound strange.
Yeah,
it really does.
And you know, we use Tannoys, and if you don't know that speaker,
yeah,
you're going to be in for a shock. You know,
well, it's borrowing someone else's glasses or something.
The speaker is very true, and it reveals everything. You know, when you have a mistake, it's going to tell you. You know? Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good thing you don't master my commercials. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, man.
Appreciate you coming over. Martin, how you doing, man? You've been kind of sitting there just soaking it all up.
Staying awake.
Are you on West Coast time, East Coast time?
No, I'm West Coast time. Okay. Down here to prepare for the AS show.
Oh, okay.
A few weeks.
Yeah. Great.
There'll be a lot to talk about then.
Rob,
yes,
you have anything you're working on you can plug? Yeah.
Stuff I'm working on I can plug. Doing a bunch of commercials that I can't quite talk about yet. You know what? You caught me on one of those weeks where there's not much I can talk about.
That would be a no, Mike.
We're finishing up. Actually, one of the cool things is we've been back in the studio tracking music with Stevie's rhythm section, not for a Stevie project, but for another project, and it's charitable. It's music that's going to be, the proceeds are going to be donated to charity, and it's been a lot of fun because anytime we get that band together,
right.
You know, with Nate playing bass and everything, it's beyond a party. I mean, it's just
who's playing drums?
Jerry Brown.
Oh, yeah, it's
just the old crew, and it is incredible.
Oh, man.
And Kyle Bolden played guitar, who's a young kid who was, you know, probably in diapers when we were doing all the original Stevie stuff, but it's just been a lot of fun, and they're just so good, and it feels like it's very comfortable because, you know, we've been working together forever. So we've been doing that for a project that I'll be able to actually talk about really soon.
Great. Well,
but yeah, we're just right in the middle of working on all these things right before we're allowed to talk about
them. Well, we will pick your brain next time.
Yes.
Hey, Martin, are you? Do you want to plug anything from Sankin or any of the other?
Putting me on the spot here.
How's the 100K microphone?
That's doing still fine. And
That's my next microphone as soon as I get enough jelly beans together.
We actually have a lot of, not a lot, but some game companies buying them for doing sound effects.
Yeah.
When you say 100K, is it dollars or frequency?
Frequency, thank God.
It's digital?
It's an analog microphone, but it records up to 100 kilohertz.
Yeah, when you listen to the mic, it's just has this open presence on the high end that's like this.
Just goes.
Yeah, and all I can think of is, you know, recording at 96K with a 100K microphone and just the ability just to tweak that sound, you know, pitch shift and bringing it down and just all kinds of good stuff.
You can do.
We should say that Sankin makes it, right?
That's right.
Sankin see a 100K.
Yeah. First time I heard it in the AES, I don't know if you're going to AES, but they have them over at this little display. It's just, even though you're in this big, noisy, you know, convention hall, you put the headphones on, you hear it just like that.
Hmm. Are there any examples online of things recorded on the mic?
Michael Bishop might have some things. He won the last two surround classic surround recording Grammys.
And
this is your 100K.
Telarc.
Yeah.
Former Telarc.
Former.
Yeah. He has his own business now.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
All right, well, we'll be looking for you over at AES.
See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, listening to the
to the microphones. And I will be over there just drooling and just longing. Brandon, are you working on anything?
Working on a lot of the same trailers that I have in the last few weeks. The sci-fi thing called I Am Number 4, Superheroes, Aliens. Building up the sound design collection for Synchronic.
Nice.
Synchronicsound.com.
And your trailer's still playing, right? That you have the queue on?
Oh, yeah. A queue of mine is in the True Grit trailer.
Great.
It's the song that comes right after the Johnny Cash song.
Cool.
So, yeah.
So we will look that up
That's
online.
That's where it is. And I'm actually mastering, although I'm not a mastering engineer by any means, mastering a friend's, you know, demo band album. Yeah. And, yeah, it's been great to talk to you guys about that and absorb a little.
Don't you feel so unworthy saying that?
I do.
After meeting Gene, I just feel so unworthy. I've mastered something before. Okay, maybe not mastered. I've tweaked some dials and, you know.
Yeah, you missed it. Which is not as good.
I feel so unworthy. Bill.
All right. Edit.
You like that. Edit.
You know, I sold 5 songs to a Disney show, The Science of Imagineering.
Oh, great.
So that's cool. And a lot of you guys don't know, I came to Austin to be a part of, to head up the creative and audio production division of an all audio ad agency. And we have some software that when you call somebody, major retailer or whatever, we can tell you by your phone number certain things about you, and we drop a customized audio stream in front of you on the fly.
Wow.
And so I've had to not only build all these commercials and spots and vocal prompts and press one, all that kind of stuff, but I've had to integrate everything within a whole engineering community. So everything down to the way the file is named. You know, I've got to output 4 mixes and I've got to take it all the way down to 8-bit. And the file name has to stay the same because the software can't recognize the audio unless the file name is exactly the same.
Wow.
So I'm learning a lot. I really went through a discouraging period where the phone, you know, when you're talking over the phone, that codec was developed in 1972. It's called G.711. And it's the actual codec is a broadcast, it's a wave file called MuLaw, and it is the most harsh, difficult codec ever. And basically it's optimized for voice, and it's brutal. So I've been working and working and working to get that to sound good. And so
good luck.
I'm on the other ass end of the deal from the mastering guys.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
Wow.
Well, and lucrative.
Well, that's great. Well, we'll have to find out some more of that information and exactly how do you mangle it enough to get it down to 8-bit? Is that where you don't really hear it? You just imply music or you imply sound effects?
No, I mean, it's brutal. I have to, I'm using a thing called Sound Grinder because when you try to export out of Pro Tools at 8-bit, 8K, it just sucks so hard. It's unreal.
Anyway, yeah.
Wow. Bob and I will speak to Digi about that, but
yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I've had to learn all new stuff and it's kind of nice to be in audio and going along. And then all of a sudden you get a left turn where you have to use all your skills, but in a completely unintuitive direction. And so that's where I'm at. That's what I'm doing.
Well,
you said it's interesting and lucrative, which are two things that are hard to find in a gig these days. So
yeah. So I wouldn't complain.
No, he's not complaining.
No, I know.
Until my electronic music career takes off, this will do.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for joining us, and you know, we'll have you back more often, buddy.
Always a pleasure, boys.
All right. Don't melt out there in Austin. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So, Bobby. Really quick, before I ask you what you're up to, there's a listener actually had a question for you. You mentioned on one of our podcasts that you're working on a book about building a home studio along those lines.
yeah.
or setting up a home studio.
Yeah.
And he was just inquiring if there was any more information and when that might be coming out, or...
Or could you just go hook up his home studio?
Well, no,
it's about acoustics, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's building the acoustics in the studio. It'll be finished... well, it's finished now. It'll be out for NAMM, for Winter NAMM.
Oh, great.
Cool.
Well, that's good. Yeah, because they were talking about also like the sweet spot and a few other things, and there's people asking questions about that. So that's going to be...
That's all in there. And that segues into what I've been doing, because there's a DVD that goes with it, so I'm actually in production of that right now.
Oh, cool.
So I'm in video world, in editing world for the next couple of weeks.
Wow.
I'm also giving a two-day presentation at AES, Social Engineer for Musicians and Engineers. Part one and part two on Friday and Saturday.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll have to go sneak in there.
So that's and it's information that, you know, it's funny because I think it, you know, everybody ought to know this, and I'm constantly surprised when I find out that people don't know these things. So
right.
it's a combination of some real basics about social media and social networking and, you know, some advanced stuff, some SEO, SEM stuff. SEO is search engine optimization or search engine marketing, which, you know, a lot of people don't understand or don't really know what that is. So it's how to incorporate it to actually get more clients, talk to the clients that you have. If you're a musician, talk to your fans, grow your audience, things like that.
Great. Well, that's pretty cool, and we'll look forward to that. If you're going to AES, I strongly suggest attending that because Bobby is a wealth of information. What is it with the Bobbies here? The Bobbies here are...
It's a very Bobby-heavy
they really know their stuff.
They do?
Well, that's great. Well, one thing I wanted to make a really quick announcement to everybody is that we have a new panel member, and that is Bobby Osinski. He has agreed to join us as a panel member. And so I wanted to welcome him to the panel.
So he's not an intern anymore?
He did his internship and passed with flying colors. No, right. we are more than honored to have you join us on the panel.
Well, thank you kindly.
That's Mike. Great.
And guys, it's a lot of fun.
I'm glad we didn't scare you away.
We're going to pick your brain to pieces.
That's right. So,
what have you been working on there, Mike, before we go?
Big news on the Audio Nowcast front. We've actually started production on Audio Nowcast Spaces. And that was a video series that we tried to do. Okay, I tried to do a couple of years ago and just wasn't the time and nor was the technology there to make it happen the way we need to make it happen. But we're going to be doing our first couple shoots in these next week. In 2 weeks, I'm flying out to Dallas. And basically, the Audio Nowcast Spaces is going to be kind of a magazine format made for the web series on interviewing and highlighting places where music is made, played, or listened to. And you know, we're not just going to go into big studios, although we are going to go and visit a couple studios, and we're going to probably profile every one of the guys here on the podcast. But we're also going to go into listener studios where they make their own music, because today music is made in all kinds of places, and you'll be amazed that, you know, some great stuff coming out of little closets or coming out of just a laptop or coming out of this. So, you know, if you're out there, and I'll give you a heads up when we're going to be hitting your city, and we'd love to come out and talk to you and hang out with you and kind of see it. And like I said, we're going to be doing our first shoot in Dallas and highlighting a couple of cool things out there, and then we're going to do L.A., and then we're going to be hitting New York in December. So I'll keep everybody posted on our Facebook page, which, by the way, is a great way to communicate with us and to ask us questions. You can visit facebook.com/audionowcast. So that's what's happening with the podcast. So
pretty cool.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. And, you know, we may get one episode. We may stop
and
after one.
And you're working on some stuff that actually pays you as well, right? I would hope.
Oh, no, I lost that gig a long time.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm just, you know, doing all the post-production things, still helping Martin out with his album. His album's going to be coming out, and he'll be back.
Oh, and that's something we have to mention, actually. Martin Page and Bobby Summerfield.
Right.
Well, Martin has a song on Robbie Williams' new album. It's a greatest hits album, but it has one new song on it, and the song on there is a song that Martin did on his last album.
Yeah, The Long Walk Home.
Long Walk Home, and Bobby Summerfield produced it with Martin and they
cut
for
the,
Robbie.
Yeah, they cut the vocals in Bobby's studio.
Yep, and it turned out great, and the album came out, and it was number one in the UK. It sold over 100,000 the first, whatever that chunk of time was. It's been out for, a week or two now?
Yeah, like a
week. It's pretty new, but it's doing great, so both those guys are invisible panel members tonight, but congratulations to them.
And Diego, he's working on something. He sent me a text actually while we were recording. He couldn't make it tonight, but he definitely plans on being back, and he's working. And I know Scott is out.
He's on the other side of town mixing a film.
Yeah, he's mixing a film, and so pretty soon we'll have everybody back in and gathering of the tribe.
I think we did just fine without them.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's been a great podcast. I do want to mention that if you have any comments or questions for any of the panel members, you can always reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And once again, you can also catch us on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/audio nowcast. You know what? I don't know how these radio guys do it. Right? I mean, you listen to talk radio, they do a 3-hour show every day, and if their voice is going like my voice is going, those guys are superheroes.
Your voice sounds great tonight, man.
Yeah, you sound really
best it's ever
huge.
Sounded.
Great.
Or as some people say, it sounds manly.
Manly.
All right. Well, once again, Gene, thank you so much for joining us, and you guys should check out his site, and we'll post a link to it. And Bobby, welcome to the panel.
Thank you.
And we cannot forget Jeremy. Jeremy, thank you for all your help.
All right, Jeremy.
You guys are all welcome to come by.
Oh, I'd love to. Cool. Love to. Absolutely. Cool. There you go. There's another segment for the Audio Nowcast Spaces.
For Spaces.
Oasis.
Spaces. Hey, there you go. All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.